This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Just about every one of us cries with Oprah, smirks along with Jon Stewart, laughs at the wacky antics on our favorite sitcoms, and thrills to the race against time on 24. We mutter about what stinks and emerge from the depths of our lazy boys convinced that TV critic has to be the easiest job in the world. Paid to watch TV? I could do that. Writer Lee Siegel has sat through years' worth of drama, sitcoms, reality, and news as television critic for The New Republic, and he emerges to tell us that not just any idiot can get paid to watch The Tube. In a collection of his essays, Siegel analyzes the history of the cop show and explains why it will never go away. He criticizes critical favorites, Jon Stewart and Larry David, compares Oprah to Picasso, and wonders where the medium and the country that stares at it may be headed. Later on in the hour, the death of the immigration bill and how the bald eagle remade its image. But first, we talk TV culture with Lee Siegel. Hands up, everybody who tuned in to watch Paris Hilton on Larry King last night. If you have questions about the nature of the medium and why we watch what we watch, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. Lee Siegel's book is called Not Remotely Controlled, Notes on Television. He joins us from our bureau in New York. Nice to have you on the program today.
Oh, it's nice to be here.
And I assume that any respectable television critic had to be watching Paris Hilton and Larry King last night.
Oh, no. Well, you know, when I got off the TV beat a year ago, I did retire mostly from the television to spend more time with my family. But I do keep an eye on it, yes. Although I did miss Paris Hilton. You know how the solitary figure confronted the tank in Tiananmen Square years ago? Well, I thought not watching Paris Hilton would have a similar inspiring effect.
I was interested, though, to read your many profiles of many of the different people on TV. Larry King is not among them.
No, first of all, I couldn't write about everyone. I would have liked to write about him. He's certainly a fascinating figure. He's become a kind of icon himself, of course, but I missed him.
You missed him. Nevertheless, the article on Oprah Winfrey is both dizzying in its praise and interesting in its criticism.
Well, I think she inspires extreme emotions, just as her show brings together extreme emotional states. She's a very complex figure.
One of the things you write is there's a quiet revolution underway at Oprah's behest, and that a way she has managed to make the black experience from slavery part of the everyday mainstream American experience.
Yes. Well, first of all, I think, as I wrote in that essay, that she's done more for race relations than any other, certainly any other figure in the world of entertainment, and almost as much maybe in her realm as Martin Luther King. You know, she tells stories about people in bondage to circumstances, to compulsions. The stories end with redemption. There's the quest for literacy. With her book club, it's something like the slave narrative of the antebellum South.
Do you really think George H.W. Bush, who presided over the spectacularly successful Gulf War, lost to Bill Clinton in 1992 because of a sagging economy, you write? No, it was Oprah, stupid. It was Oprah behind Clinton in 92, also in 96. It was Oprah behind George W. Bush in 2000 and 2004, electoral shenanigans notwithstanding. How does Oprah translate into support for Clinton and or George Bush?
Well, I think we've gone from worshiping images of perfection to worshiping images of gross imperfection. I think reality TV is a rebellion against the images of perfection that we encounter every day in fashion magazines and the silver screen in advertising. And I think Oprah, as you said, spearheaded this rebellion against these ideal images. I think people are very impatient with perfection. I think that's part of the reason people were so hard on poor Al Gore. You know, his poise was described as wooden. His patriarchal background was caricatured as a remoteness from ordinary life. And then you get this bumbling idiot in the White House who I think was in part somehow responded to this rebellion against these ideal images, because after all, if the images are ideal, well, we have to, someone's tricking us. You know, it's just too good to be true. Bush, he empowered our sense of seeing through pretense. It was all right there, so it seemed.
Yet Winfreyism, you conclude, is the expression of an immensely reassuring and inspiring message that has, without doubt, helped millions of people carry on with their lives. It is also an empty, cynical, icily selfish outlook on life that undercuts its own positive energy at every turn.
Yes, well, I think on the one hand, you know, you sit before her tube as though sitting before, huddling before a fireplace, and you hear these warm stories of human redemption and inspiring examples of people overcoming adversity, etc. But at the same time, she'll shift from a mother who returns home to find her children dead to a T-shirt contest, and she's steeped in materialist values, and she makes everything look easy. She makes life look easy, and life isn't so easy.
We're talking with Lee Siegel. His new book is called Not Remotely Controlled: Notes on Television. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. Let's begin with Matthew. Matthew with us from Chillicothe in Ohio.
Hi, yes. I really like your program, and I'm a first-time caller, and I'm very excited to talk to your guest. I just had one question about The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, and I was wondering what he thought about how it has been affecting the youth of today and their views politically.
I think, and I'm certainly in the minority, and I'm going to have to watch myself when I leave the building after this broadcast, but I do think that it's having a kind of a paralyzing cynical effect. You know, Neil, you said at the beginning of the segment, we smirk when we watch Jon Stewart. It's not laughter. It's taunting. It's mockery. It's derision. And it just makes people feel that all political effort or all effort in the public realm is a sham, a transparently hollow thing. I don't think there's anything inspiring about Stewart. On the other hand, there was nothing politically inspiring about Lenny Bruce, but at least he was funny. He didn't just ride the news and show silly little mashups of the 6 o'clock evening news.
Well, a lot of people think Jon Stewart's funny.
Well, you know, I'm sure for them he is, and humor is very subjective, and maybe I'm completely wrong, but I just don't see anything funny about sarcasm, about taunting and pointing, and as I said, these mashups where you use the news to really ride the news, you never get away from the news. You know, he's drowning under the information that a good comic just sort of explodes to clear a space for us. And
well, one of the things you do in the book, in the essay on Jon Stewart, is you write about his interview with Richard Clark. He describes Clark, Stewart describes Clark's book as mind-blowing. It was insane. His book and the testimony at the 9/11 hearings provided a window into how our government functions. And you said that while you may agree with Richard Clark and think he's a wonderful human being, this is not necessarily the role of comedy.
Right. I agreed with Clark. I don't know if he's a wonderful human being, but I certainly agreed with him, and I was glad for the revelations in his book. But comedy is not about edification, you know. I don't think it should be morally instructive. It should be explosive, like Richard Pryor was explosive, flying apart, you know, rearranging all the ordinary givens. And I think Clark should have been celebrated, but as a public figure who was full of his own folly, he should have been lampooned. He was treated too respectfully.
Thanks for the call, Matthew.
Thank you.
And while as long as we're arranging the escort for you on the way out the building, Larry David, another critic favorite, you say stands comedy on its head, and you don't mean that in a good way.
Well, in the beginning, I thought that David really, you know, that instead of puncturing the big guy, he deflated the little guy. It was all about his disappointments at the hands of various people in the service industry. A waitress disappoints him. Someone who sells him a new pair of eyeglasses disappoints him. And he had reversed the comic dynamic. You know, that was at the beginning. Now I think having read my review, obviously, he's improved.
He's taken your advice, yeah.
He's improved, and I watch him. I think he's funny now.
You think he's funny now?
Yeah.
All right. Well, at that point, we can cancel the extra half dozen. We're talking with Lee Siegel from our bureau in New York. His new book is Not Remotely Controlled, Notes on Television. You said a few minutes ago you left the TV beat to spend more time with your family. Is it a relief not to? It's almost impossible to keep up.
It is impossible. That's so true. It's just, you know, there's so much on now with the advent of cable television, and you flip from one thing to another. And one of the drawbacks to being a TV critic is that you have to review shows on the basis of just one or two or at the most three episodes. And, you know, a literary critic would never dream of reviewing a novel on the basis of the first three chapters. But that's what you have to do, because you have to go on to the next show. I thank heavens that I was a weekly critic and not a daily critic.
Mm-hmm. And it's obviously an ephemeral medium, and we can judge that just on the basis of some of the programs that you review, which are scarcely remembered. Growing Up Gotti, Super Nanny, 30 Days, Stump the Schwab. These don't last very long, some of them, perhaps rightly.
Well, perhaps rightly. They come and go so fast, you don't know whether they deserve to be there or not. You know, room has to immediately be made for the next sensational thing. You're dealing, after all, with not just artistic phenomena, but commercial juggernauts. That's the hybrid nature of being a TV critic.
We're talking with Lee Siegel. We'd like to take more of your calls, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And you can also check out our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. I'm Neil Conan. When we come back, we're going to be talking about the genesis and history and future history of the cop show. Lee Siegel says it will never go away. And about the nature of a medium at a technological crossroads. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We all have a dream job in mind, and for a lot of us, TV critic might be near the top of the list. Lee Siegel spent years reviewing television programs, and sadly, he says it's not so easy. His new book is a collection of his essays on TV shows from the New Republic and the changing television business. It's called Not Remotely Controlled, Notes on Television. To read what he has to say about why we love our cop shows, you can check out an excerpt at our website, npr.org/talk. If you have questions about the nature of television, the medium, or the business, and why we watch what we watch, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. And you can also join us on our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. And I wanted to talk about cop shows, but here's a related email. This is from Scott in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Growing up, I loved private eye shows like Magnum P.I., Moonlighting, Rockford Files, Simon & Simon, God Help Me, Riptide, and others. What happened to this once prominent and entertaining genre, Veronica Mars, appears to be the only exception.
Oh, that's a great question. I don't know what's happened to the private eye shows. You know, they seem to have gone the way of film noir, where you also had a lot of private eyes. I think maybe because the private eye was in taking the uniform off the cop, you were able to portray a law enforcement person in a much more kind of ambiguous way, as more tormented and so forth. I think since cop shows themselves have gotten, since NYPD Blue, so complex, so psychologically complex, you don't need to make that shift into the private eye.
Mm. Whereas cops, you say, on the big screen and the small, cops enthrall us the way gods and demigods captured the imaginations of ancient Greeks and Romans.
Well, a cop is in a radically individualist culture, the cop is the individual in crisis, right? I mean, the cop who's at odds with his superiors and also trying to get the bad guys, he's stretching the very limits of individual integrity and capacity and power. That's why we're so fascinated by it, I
mm-hmm.
think.
Is it of a piece with Western starring a sheriff?
Well, they're certainly related. I think, again, after the war, when you had film noir, I think that gradually displaced the Western. You know, things had just gotten too kind of shady
mm-hmm.
After the war, and it wasn't it was too much to have a guy with a hat and a badge. You really needed someone lost in the big city, you know, and blending into the shadows. It's very hard to. There are no shadows in westerns, really, right? It's too much sunlight. Everybody's out in the open.
Well, some of those modern westerns.
You know. Oh yes, Deadwood, of course.
Yeah. Right, now you say in a way the modern police show was NYPD Blue, and that three different types of cop shows grew out of it.
Yeah, well, you had NYPD Blue, which was the, as I said earlier, the kind of the beginning of the psychologically complex cop, the forerunner of today's the Shield, and then you had the reaction against that. You had cop shows where things were much more simple. Then the third type, I've completely forgotten. I'm back watching TV. This is what happens.
Well, we've gone through the gritty type, have we?
That comes from NYPD Blue. Mm-hmm. There's the reality cop show, which in a sense is more idealized than these cop dramas like Hill Street Blues and NYPD Blue. The reality cop show, which is it's called Cops. That shows public servants just doing what they do. Cops going out arrest. It doesn't show them drinking. It doesn't show them in bursting marriages. It doesn't show them brooding over guilty actions they committed in the past. It's much more.
It's back to Dragnet.
It's back to Dragnet and back to the ordinary person's experience of the police. Right. We don't experience the police as these tormented figures. We expect them to help us when we need help.
Let's get some more callers on the line. Again, we're talking with Lee Siegel about his book, Not Remotely Controlled. This is Al. Al's with us from Cape Coral in Florida.
Yes. Whatever happened to science fiction on television? From Lost in Space all the way to Deep Space Nine, all of a sudden it's disappeared.
Well, you have science fiction in politics now. You don't need it on television. You have science fiction on the life is becoming more like science fiction.
Yes, but they gave us in the 60s and 70s and 80s they gave us a hopeful and optimistic view of the future. Now the only view of the future we have is global warming, overpopulation, and the sinking of the American economy.
Right. So who needs science fiction?
Perhaps.
Well, maybe if you need some hope, but for that you say tune into Oprah.
If you tune into Oprah or listen to an old Rod McEwen recording.
Al, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
All right. In a way, there are an awful lot of semi-science fiction. I mean, even Lost, because there's certain science fiction elements in that.
Well, I think all the boundaries are blurring. You know, John from Cincinnati, this new HBO drama that has elements of at least fantasy, if not science fiction, people levitating off the ground and so forth. There was there were religious programs for a while. Revelation, yes. Joan of Arcadia, of course, where characters were being spoken to by God. That's a kind of science fiction. But I think science fiction, insofar as it exists, is now a combination of religion and fantasy.
Let's get this is Jeff. Jeff's with us from East Lansing in Michigan.
Hi. You were talking about Oprah a little bit earlier.
Yeah.
And I think she's pretty much the exception. But what happened to black people on TV? I mean, I'm black, I'm African-American, and I'm always looking for black folks on TV, and I rarely see them. Network, HBO, whatever.
Well, what happened to black people in movies? What happened to black people in contemporary literature? What happened to black people in general? I simply don't think the black experience is represented in any medium the way it should be. And I don't know.
America.
Yeah, well, part of the reason, you know, Spike Lee once said that it's because what we need are more black professionals making money in the various professions in business and pouring money into the production of art, and maybe that's so. But I couldn't agree with you more. The few things that are on are gems like Everybody Hates Chris, that was a wonderful show. No one wanted to touch the representation of blacks in The Sopranos. I love The Sopranos, but no one was very critical of The Sopranos.
Right.
I don't see it. There's a great cartoon, The Boondocks,
right.
That great Magruder cartoon, which is more honest about race than anything else on television. But I agree with you. I don't know why.
There are black characters in it. You know, all these ensemble dramas that have at least one black character.
Well, that's true, but it's still not enough, and they're often the ensemble, and the black character is often very predictable. as sitcoms are, but I don't see a black Sopranos. I don't see a black Little House on the Prairie. You know, I'd like to see that.
Hmm. And so, I think in the black, in the ensembles, it almost feels like the black character is like the rule of one. Oh, we got to have one. Hmm. So it's a sad state to me. Well, thank
you. I agree with you, and I think TV critics and cultural critics should write more about it. That's all.
I agree. Thanks.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. You also write about the nature of the medium itself, and obviously we're a long ways away from the days of, you know, the three big broadcast networks and maybe, if you were lucky in your market, a couple of independent stations. We're in a cable television world now, 500 stations and nothing on, but the dinosaurs, the network's still hanging on.
Well, I think they'll always hang on. You know, there's a lot of money there, and a lot of power, but they're slowly changing as well. They'll have to. Everybody's rushing to adapt to a new world that's taking shape, though no one really knows what the shape is, and no one even knows how new it is. Mm-hmm. Everyone's running around frightened. But there's no doubt that the screen is now central in the culture, more central than literary culture. The computer screen, the TV screen, the movie screen. And even if, as things seem to be going, we will be able to hold all of culture in our palm at one point, mm-hmm. It will still be a screen.
But there is also the reality, market fragmentation. And, for example, you go back to radio, which, of course, had competition from broadcasting with pictures in the 1950s or so. But what happened to radio when more channels became available, FM, was market fragmentation. Every radio station decided not to compete against every other radio station, but against the three others that were broadcasting their brand of classic rock or whatever it was. You see that happening in TV?
There's a certain amount of that, but, you know, if you look at, everyone's talking about these things, fragmentation. It's very astute of you to bring that up, because there was a book called The Long Tail, which is all about creating particularized niches. Mm-hmm. But if you look at YouTube, for example, which is a kind of TV, you know, if you look at that, everyone seems to be doing their own thing, but everyone's really copying everybody else. And if you look at American Idol, what are they doing? Well, they're creating a pastiche of famous musician styles. I don't know if all this fragmentation will result in the thriving of unique taste or in a new kind of conformity.
Hmm. I tend to watch, writes an email from Matthew, I tend to watch the whole season of a series, even on DVD, sans commercials. Do you think that this is an important development? I guess TiVo would have to be thrown into that.
Well, TiVo is something else. TiVo is absolutely disorienting. TiVo almost ruined my marriage at a certain point because I kept rewinding. I had to hear every word. You know, I get very, very neurotic. My wife threatened to leave me. We stopped getting TiVo because of that. But the DVD developed. Well, that's an interesting thing, because then you can start enjoying TV almost as a solitary art, like a novel. You don't have to go to it when it's on. You don't have to be interrupted. You just buy it and you put it on the way you would open a good book. And I think that's very consequential. Yeah.
Well, was there anything for you that we're laughing along here, called the divorce channel? You've heard this description of, for example, ESPN Classic, where one partner turns to the other and says, "Do you mean to tell me you're watching a football game and you already know who won?"
and that's cause for divorce?
Yeah, I think that's the last straw channel, maybe it might be.
Not in New York, though, only in Southern California.
Uh-huh. That could be. Let's get another caller on the line. This is Ryan. Ryan's with us from Des Moines in Iowa.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a truck driver, and I have to be very selective in what I watch. And, you know, I like to watch House, which is well-reviewed, and then on TLC, there's a Little People, Big World, which is really kind of a gem about adversity and family values, but I don't hear a single review about it. And I was wondering how you decide what shows you review, if you have a list that you're given or what. And my phone's going dead, so I'll take my answer out there.
Okay, Ryan, thanks for the call. Drive carefully.
Yeah, well, don't watch too much while you're driving. How do I decide? Well, it's partly you have to review things. That's a good question. Partly you have to review things because other people are talking about them. And partly you review on the basis of personal taste. You're interested in something. It's always a combination of various pressures. Your boss might ask you to review something, you know.
Mm-hmm. And now that you're not in the TV reviewing business anymore, what do you decide to watch? What do you like?
Well, I watch what I like. I have to say, you know, as a critic, you're always trying to find kind of a place of critical detachment. Mm-hmm. You don't find yourself liking what everyone else likes too often. But I did love The Sopranos. In fact, I wrote a very long essay about it, which is in my previous book of essays called Falling Upwards. And I do think The Sopranos was a kind of breakthrough for television. And I was watching that right up to the end.
We're watching. We're listening to Lee Siegel. His book is called Not Remotely Controlled: Notes on Television. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. So right up to the end, that finale, what did you think?
Well, it's funny, you know, people think different things about that. I noticed that in the New York Post critic was very angry about the ending and critical of it.
Mm-hmm.
More so-called sophisticated critics celebrated it as a new development in culture, a rebellion against closure and so forth. And it was that. But I think that HBO, and no one writes about this because no one wants to write about class in America, I think HBO appeals to a certain class, a kind of upper middle class or upper class of people, or an advanced type of intellectual. I don't think that the stories are vertical. They have no plots. I don't know why people were so shocked by the ending. A lot of the individual episodes throughout the show's history didn't really have an ending. There was no closure. There was no beginning, middle, and end. And I admire it, but it makes me feel uneasy.
Hmm.
You know, I think a lot of people out there in Hollywood land who make movies, they lead very privileged lives. Their five senses are gratified every minute. And their time is disconnected. Their moments are disconnected. And for the rest of us, our moments are sort of bound by a need. We go from need to need. Needs have beginning, middles, and ends. And we like stories.
Hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, religious people like stories. And I wonder if all the admiration of the end of The Sopranos was part of this backlash against religion now that you're getting in a certain class of the society. I also thought that Mike Bloomberg throwing his hat up in the air rather than in the ring was his version of The Sopranos ending as a kind of maybe not beginning.
Yeah, so Sopranos opening, if you will.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Let's see if we get one more caller in. This is Renee. Renee's with us from Charleston, South Carolina.
Hi. How y'all doing?
Very well, thanks.
Hi.
I was a theater major, and we took a class that was theater history, and our teacher drew a parallel between how theater changed in Rome to more of like the Colosseum, you know, gladiators, where it wasn't really a piece of art, and it showed the decline of their civilization. So do you feel that reality TV is kind of paralleling that in today's society, where it's not really a thought art piece, more as real people and editing?
Oh, I think that's a very shrewd thing to say. Absolutely. I think that story, substance, is giving away to spectacle. You've got that all over, not just on TV. You know,
yeah.
On TV we lurch from reality show to reality show, from one sensational event to another sensational event. But you've got it in the blogosphere, the gotcha ethics of the bloggers. You know, you've got it in this information culture, these streams of information which are really disconnected spectacles in a way, with no story or idea connecting them.
Well,
we're watching that.
All your listeners support the theater, because I'm an actress and all those reality TV shows are taking our employment away.
Well, I'd love to see a playwright write or some sort of satire or a parody of the. I think reality TV is ripe for a destructive
mm-hmm.
parody.
Mm.
So please rally all your brethren
and
all your comrades. And
thank you very much. I love your show, by the way.
Oh, thank you very much, Renee.
Take care.
And I would, if we had time, I would cite Lee Siegel's essay on Reno 911, which he does say satirizes a lot of reality TV shows. Lee Siegel, thanks very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Lee Siegel joined us from our bureau in New York. His book is Not Remotely Controlled: Notes on television. Up next, the immigration bill dies in the Senate. We'll talk about the impact of today's vote, and NPR's Ron Elving will join us. Plus, the American bald eagle gets an image makeover and makes a comeback. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.